running away to get away. Ha 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 ha, you're wearing out your shoes.
Okay, so I'm here with Peniel Joseph, who is most recently the author of Dark Days, Bright Nights. Professor Joseph, how are you doing?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure. I wanted to start off with Malcolm X, predictably enough, because that, of course, is in the first major part of this book. When Malcolm X delivered his famous Ballot of the Bullets speech, you point out that newspapers ignored his more tangible call for 1 million new black voters for a black nationalist political party. Now, black voters, as we all know, were instrumental in getting Obama elected in November. I'm wondering, though, because they were not necessarily black nationalists, whether Malcolm X's call was entirely heeded.
Well, I think his call is going to be heeded into the next generation, at least. When we think about when Malcolm said that in 1964, there was no Congressional Black Caucus. There were no black senators since Reconstruction. There were no black governors. There wasn't the wave of black mayors that we start having, starting in 1967 with Richard Hatcher in Gary, Indiana, Carl Stokes in Cleveland. By 1970, Kenneth Gibson in Newark, New Jersey. In the early 70s, 73, 74, you're going to have Coleman Young in Detroit, Maynard Jackson in Atlanta. By 1983, you have Harold Washington in Chicago, and that's the Chicago that Barack Obama comes of political age in, at least, even though he grows up in Hawaii. He's born in Hawaii August 4th, 1961. So I think African-American voters in the 1970s and the 1980s take heed to this politics of racial solidarity, for the most part. There's going to be exceptions. People like Edward Brooke, the first black senator in the 20th century, elected in a general election in 1966 from the state of Massachusetts. Tom Bradley becomes mayor of Los Angeles after the 1973 election in a city that only has 10% African Americans. But for the most part, there's really a racial script where you're going to get black elected officials in places like New Orleans. Mississippi becomes the state that has the most black state representatives and elected officials. It doesn't have a senator, doesn't have a governor, but it has the most elected officials out of any of the states. Decades after the segregation of Freedom Summer and the assassinations of those three civil rights workers, Shorney, Cheney, and Goodman, two white and one black. So when we think about Malcolm's call, it is heated for the 70s and 80s, but as we get into the 90s and the 21st century, there's going to be some real notable exceptions. People like L. Douglas Wilder, who becomes governor of Virginia in 1989. People like Deval Patrick, who becomes governor of Massachusetts in 2006. People like Barack Obama, who becomes a senator out of Illinois in 2004. People like Carolyn Mosley Braun, who becomes a senator in 1992. So when we think about racial politics, the politics of racial solidarity for elections is still there. I mean, when you think about Bobby Rush, who Obama ran against in 2000 for the South Side of Chicago congressional district, that's a black district. Most likely, you're always going to have an African-American representative there. So the politics of racial solidarity are there, but at the same time, there's a new class of African-American elected officials, people like Cory Booker in Newark, New Jersey, who are really doing a pan-racial appeal. They're saying, look, I'm an elected official, but I am also black, but I happen to be black. They're not coming out in a very robust way talking about black solidarity and that the reason why I should be mayor of Newark is because I'm black. Yeah. Michael Nutter in Philadelphia is the same way. Duval Patrick, the same way, where they're saying, I happen to be black, but I'm going to be an elected official for all people.
I'm curious if it takes someone like a Harold Washington or an Obama to create that one particular figure who both revolutionaries and those who believe in the pragmatism, revolutionary can be pragmatism too in its own ways, but those who believe also in elected politics, because there's always been a fractiousness going on between the two figures within the black power movement of the last four decades in particular. So does it take some brand new figure to unite, or is it possible to have, I suppose, someone who can leave a legacy beyond, I suppose, the elected moment?
Well, I'd say it depends on the time period, because I think when we look at the late 60s, early 70s, black militants and black elected officials had real coalitions and ties. I think the best example of that is Amiri Baraka and Kenneth Gibson in Newark, New Jersey, and also the Gary Convention in March of 1972. And the Gary Convention was a national black political convention attended by 12,000 people. And the co-conveners were Congressman Charles Diggs from Michigan, Mayor Richard Hatcher of Gary, Indiana, and Amiri Baraka, who held no elected position, but was just a black nationalist poet and an organizer. So there was this coalition, but by the middle 70s, that coalition is going to fracture, really amid mutual recriminations. Politicians are going to accuse militants of being sort of wild-eyed dreamers who don't understand the politics of governance and the pragmatism that governance really precipitates. I mean, to be an elected official is to be somebody who has to be pragmatic and to compromise. Militants are going to accuse black elected officials of being the worst kind of sellouts, people who really utilize a politics of racial solidarity to get into office, and as soon as they get into office, they use the power of municipal politics and City Hall to enrich themselves and their cronies. And I think you're going to see that tension over the next 40 years, but there's going to be notable exceptions. One is Harold Washington, who has a coalition of pragmatists and militants, and somehow in 4.5 years as mayor manages to please them all, because Washington's reelected and dies of a heart attack right around Thanksgiving of 1987, but is very much well regarded in Chicago. Another mayor is going to be, surprisingly, Marion Barry of the 1970s, at least the initial Barry. So the Barry before the huge controversies over crack cocaine and adultery and all this different stuff, had militants and moderates in his camp, and he managed to please both of them.
Very Powell-like resurgence as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And when we think about militants and moderates, in the 2008 presidential election, you saw the social movement that surrounded Obama draw in pragmatists, and it also drew in revolutionaries. So you sometimes you do see these transcendent figures. And finally, the best example in the 1980s of that is Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson runs for president in 84 and 88, really inspired by what Harold Washington was able to do. And Jesse gets 3.5 million votes in the Democratic primaries in 1984, 7 million in 1988, and he really inspires both pragmatists and militants in that campaign.
But inevitably, there still remains a fractiousness, possibly tied in Obama's case, with the failure to discuss race, which you bring up in the book, and in fact, which Michael Eric Dyson recently appeared on MSNBC in response to the Harry Reid fiasco, pointing out that Obama was a president who runs from race like a black man runs from a cop. You point in your book that Obama's reluctance to embrace race is especially ironic in light of the fact that he has a public admiration for Lincoln. You note that his appreciation remains a simplification, in as much as it largely fails to deal with the 16th president's extraordinarily complicated racial views. So the question is whether that observation and Dyson's remarks come from the same particular place. Does Obama's many political compromises that we were talking earlier, the necessity of being a politician, essentially make his failure to confront race untenable?
Well, it's very interesting. I think that we're living in a time period where politicians can talk about race in a less open way than 40 years ago. And I think that's interesting because we usually think of progress as something that's linear. It's a linear narrative. So if it's 2010 or 2010, we should be able to talk about race better than we could in 1968. That's not true in this case. We could talk about race in the late 60s in a much more candid way because of the Civil Rights Act, because of the Voting Rights Act, because of the race riots that were going on, because of the Kerner Commission. The New York Times used to be in Oregon in the late 60s, early 70s, where you had black militants who had a podium in the New York Times, were writing op-eds about black think tanks and about the Gary Convention. The Washington Post was the same way, in a way that we would find our generation extraordinary, because those august institutions won't give black militants that kind of platform anymore. So the president of the United States, in terms of Barack Obama, one of the reasons why he won, race was a positive and a negative. It was a positive in the sense that for a whole new generation of voters, especially those under 30, they found it quite refreshing that this man was running for president and took him very seriously. It was a negative, as we saw in the case of Jeremiah Wright, when critics of Obama, especially the right wing, could connect him to what was perceived as black extremism and anti-American sentiment, including things like the Black Power movement, because Jeremiah Wright is certainly coming out of a tradition of black liberation theology, which is rooted in that Black Power movement, people like James Cone, people like Reverend Albert Clegg out of Detroit. So I understand Dyson's critique, and I on some points I actually agree with Dyson's critique, and others, the notion that Obama ran utilizing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s rhetoric of the fierce urgency of now as a campaigner, but really has gotten away from that as president. But one thing I'll say is this. Part of what you have to do as a historian is look at the whole picture and not just look at snapshots. And when we look at the politics of race in the first year since the inauguration, it's going to be a year, January 20th, what we see is a couple of things. One, on one level, we've seen early racial conflagrations. The New York Post cartoon, the Attorney General Eric Holder, on February 18th, really the same day as the Post cartoon, he had the Black History Month speech where he called the nation a nation of cowards when it comes to race, something I agreed with. But what people really don't think about is that when we look at Obama's January 20th inauguration speech, he talks about race three times in that speech. He talks about those who felt the lash of the whip. He's referring to antebellum slavery. He talks about the United States coming out of the darkness of the Jim Crow era of racial segregation. And at the conclusion of his inaugural speech, he actually talks about the fact that his father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., would not have been allowed to eat at a restaurant in Washington, D.C. 40 years ago. He says 50 years ago, but it's really 40 years ago. Because remember, even after the Civil Rights Act of 64, you still have to test those things out. So people can still, for years afterwards, prevent you from sitting in and having access to public accommodations, and then you have to either file a lawsuit or get the cops or what have you. It doesn't end miraculously with a stroke of a pen. But he said, and now his son can be taking this most sacred oath. So he did acknowledge race there. He acknowledged race in the Cairo speech, where he talked about a person who looked like him in his country couldn't have voted 50 years ago. And he's talking about the evolution of American democracy. He probably acknowledges race in his most forthright way in the NAACP speech in 2009, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. And he really talks about the civil rights movement, but he also talks about contemporary racism as well. And obviously, finally, with the Skip Gates controversy, he said the Cambridge police acted stupidly. And right there, in a very forthright way, he was speaking not just as president, but really probably as an African-American who's felt racial discrimination, who's felt racial profiling. So I think you do have to put it in a context, even as you criticize the president for on one level not coming out robustly against on race matters, but he has talked about race. And when he came out and said that the Cambridge Police Department acted stupidly, you saw the vociferous criticism against this president. So in a way, many whites feel that Obama's at his best when he serves as a neutral arbiter of race relations, like the March 2008 race speech in Philadelphia in the wake of the Jeremiah Wright controversies. So I think when we talk about, and he should be rightfully criticized for not perhaps speaking more robustly about race, and I do too, but we have to give it the full nuance of all the expressions of race during his administration so far.
On the other hand, Obama also had to backtrack after the Gates incident, and the Beer Summit might be arguably a more symbolic gesture, similar to his symbolic racial neutrality that caused him to have a huge coalition of voters elect him into office. Going back to what you were mentioning earlier about the fact that there once was a time in which, yes, Stokely Carmichael did write pieces for the New Republic, which is unthinkable today.
And the New York Review of Books, too.
Yes, yes. So the question being that, is Obama essentially living up to the exigencies of contemporary media? And does contemporary media, which is rather obdurate in its particular approach right now and only lets a certain select few of acceptable viewpoints through, is that part of the problem here?
I would say yes. I'd say it's both media is part of the problem, but also the Obama administration doesn't quite know what to do with race. In terms of public policy, there's an Office of Urban Affairs, but there hasn't been the particular public policy proposals that are race-specific enough vis-a-vis things like unemployment, vis-a-vis things like the really high rate of African-American incarceration, all these different issues that racial disparities in healthcare that impact the African-American community. But at the same time, we have to remember, if he does do something that's race-specific, he's going against the grain of what most Americans feel is fair. The moral imperative of civil rights and the moral imperative of a kind of racial redemption connected to affirmative action, that there had to be some kind of payback for 100 years of slavery and 100 years of segregation, has been replaced by colorblind racism. And what I mean by colorblind racism is a notion by some on the right, but at times some on the left and liberals too, that we can declare equality by fiat. We can just say, you know what, now we're all equal, even though institutions remain the same. And if African Americans aren't getting opportunity, it must be because of their own individual flaws. So we can say, look, whether it's the NFL or corporate America, we have some black CEOs, we have some black head coaches, we have a black president, we have one black senator, we have one black governor, we have African American millionaires, we have Oprah Winfrey. We declare equality. There's no such thing as overt racial segregation anymore. So how come you folks aren't making it? So that colorblind racism really impacts, for instance, affirmative action. And we see how affirmative action has been repealed on numerous statewide ballots, right? So it really impacts the room to maneuver that President Obama has. That being said, the African-American community needs to be able to exert pressure on this president to do things that are much more race specific than the symbolism that substitutes for substance in this administration when it comes to race.
Let's go back to Stokely Carmichael, the Nation of Islam. In Dark Days, you observed that the Nation of Islam maintained the position that racial uplift strategies rather than handouts from white power brokers were the way to go about securing themselves. And in Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, you quote William Vandenberg's citation of Nixon seeing black capitalism as a promising prospect, which is interesting because you see in both cases a certain kind of ideology from the right or from capitalistic tendencies in an effort to make a broader point. This flexibility of ideology, is it something that is understated? Is it something that that is a danger to the initial tenets of the Black Power movement?
Well, I think when we think about Black Power, its overall thrust is radical, but it's very heterogeneous. And what I mean by that is that you're going to have everybody from Marxist-Leninist Black Panthers talking about a global anti-imperialist revolution, to African-American feminists, to liberal Democratic politicians saying Black Power, to more conservative politicians who are working in the Nixon administration. Floyd McKissick goes from the Black Power March in Mississippi to really trying to align himself with the Nixon administration to get federal funds for something called Soul City in North Carolina. So there is a tendency to make the concept so plastic that anybody can use it. And I think that while there is a small strain of Black Power activists who are quite conservative, who actually even had a love for Malcolm X, but they loved Malcolm's self-determination, not the radical critique of American democracy and the links between domestic anti-racist struggles and international anti-colonial struggles in Africa and elsewhere. They really liked the bootstrap philosophy of Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, which is just do it yourself, which is interesting. In the 1990s, there was an African-American urban apparel company called FUBU, and it stood for us, by us, meaning that, you know, black people were just going to do it themselves, right? No handouts, no asking for anything. So conservatives tend to play up that aspect of the movement without playing up its talk of healthcare, better schools, ending the prison industrial complex, which people were talking about in the late 60s, early 70s. One of the interesting things about Black Power is that the movement is so varied that you have everything from black high school students in places like Philadelphia, in places like Greensboro, North Carolina, in places like Los Angeles, having strikes to transform the curriculum. Obviously, black studies programs and departments at universities, whether it's at Harvard or Stony Brook or San Francisco State, black arts programs and poetry from people like Sonia Sanchez, Amiri Baraka, Nikki Giovanni, but also prisoner rights programs. So you have people And not just George Jackson in Soledad Prison and the Panthers, but cases where in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Charlotte Three, African-American prisoners who are protesting for their right for access, their right to access to radical materials, their own reading materials. The Nation of Islam protested for that too in the 1950s and 60s. And at the same time, you're gonna have black women in places like New Orleans, Louisiana, in places like Durham, North Carolina, in places like Baltimore, Maryland, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who are really leading a local black power movement on the ground for better social services, for tenants' rights, for better welfare rights, real community organizing, which goes beyond the iconography of the era. So more black people, especially black women, participated in the era outside of groups like the Black Panther Party, outside of groups like the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and outside of groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. So it's a very fascinating period. And then there's also an intellectual component to this, where we're going to see a whole host of studies on race relations, on slavery, on black intellectual, social, political thought that is really a sequel to the 19th and early 20th century founding of black studies by people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Hubert Harrison and Carter G. Woodson. And we're going to see that really transform the academy, the academic curriculum. The only reason why we have the notion of black public intellectuals and these big names now is because of what happened, obviously, in the 19th century, but especially in the 1960s. And then the very pragmatic side of it is the side where I think Obama's coming out of pragmatism and moderate, is the notion of getting what people used to say in the 60s, we want to see more black faces in higher places. So getting black lawyers, judges, Congress people, state representatives, city council people, but also corporate power. There was a notion by black moderates that, look, if there were more black people in corporate America, just by virtue of their presence, they're going to change the aesthetic of corporate America, and that's going to influence the way in which corporate America reaches out to black consumers, but also it's going to change the face of the urban ghetto and urban neighborhoods and communities. And I think in a way that still holds true. Now, is that the same as a Marxist critique saying that these institutions are going to have to be completely revamped? No, absolutely not. But does that kind of reform, is it going to have some impact, or does it? I would argue yes.
Well, to talk further about the plasticity of ideology, which we alluded to in this answer briefly, I should point out that one quality of Stokely Carmichael and the Black Panther Party that often goes overlooked is, in fact, these neighborhood community programs, breakfasts to the poor, the rebuilding of churches. Simultaneously, I want to point to Stokely Carmichael's November 7th, 1966 speech in Lowndes County, in which he depicted some of these nuances, and he managed to come away from this speech saying, wow, they really believed in black power, suggesting that the radical nature of black power was, in fact, it had some fluidity here. So to kind of corral the sort of plasticity of black power ideology being co-opted and the fact that it is, in fact, accessible in some form, even in its radical streak, I was wondering if I could get some thoughts from you on that. And I also wanted to ask if you believe that Carmichael's professed or alleged militancy came more from his rhetorical positions rather than the fireworks expected from the journalists, because media obviously factors into this.
No, I mean, I think that's a great question. In terms of Carmichael, when Carmichael makes that speech in Lowndes County, what he's talking about, he's really referring to the way in which, when we think about black power, we're just thinking about the iconography, but those people at Mount Moriah Baptist Church were just regular people. These are sharecroppers, poor black folks in Alabama, and they were living black power in a way that the media never acknowledged. They never acknowledged that this was a movement that at its base level was trying to transform American democracy. It was doing so on its own terms. It wasn't doing so with a set of prescribed terms that were approved by white liberals or clergy or the President of the United States or the federal government or people who thought of themselves as civic power brokers, right? It wasn't doing that. It was doing it on its own terms. And I think in doing it on its own terms, the quieter side of the movement always got lost. People would hear Stokely talk about self-defense. They'd hear Stokely talk about a politics of revolution. He's traveling to Cuba. He's talking about the whole world's going to change. Western civilization is going to be reduced to its knees, all these different things. So they love the polemics and the sound bites, but not the way in which it actually was evolving on the ground.
I actually wanted to talk about Stokely Carmichael being accused of being the main influence of the SBCC Black Position Paper. In both of the books, you mention this, and you point to Claiborne Carson's In Struggle as the chief text surmounting that, when in fact it was really Atlanta separatists who were behind that. I know you're doing further work on Stokely Carmichael. Are there additional resources that you've uncovered that support the Carson position that in his findings? And simultaneously, what factors account for Carmichael being almost indelibly associated with this position paper?
Well, I think the position paper, I don't think Carson says that Carmichael did the position paper. I think Carson gets it right. I think it's the New York Times that says that.
So exactly.
Yeah, the New York Times claims that he did the position paper. I think a couple of things on Stokely. When we think about Stokely Carmichael, And some of the work that I'm doing archivally, we have the FBI file on Stokely Carmichael for the first time, or at least a lot of it, because there's some pages that are redacted and different things like that. There's different stuff from the State Department. There's a whole raft of new scholarly materials and archival sources that we can use to sort of reconstruct his life. I think that the reason why he's indelibly tied to the Black Power position paper is that for the New York Times and other media, it made sense that Stokely would be saying, we want the organization to be all black. They couldn't comprehend an image of Stokely as somebody who actually got along quite well with white people, had a criticism of white liberals, but was not some conventional racial separatist. So Stokely Carmichael is not behind some push to get white people out of SNCC. And even the notion of a purge of whites from SNCC, by the time they have a meeting in December of 1966 at Peg Leg Bates, a resort in 66, there's only a couple of white people still actively working on projects. So a lot of the fervor from Freedom Summer has been lost just through attrition. Whites moving to anti-war protests, people being turned off by Black Power. And so all that occurs there is that Bob Zellner and a couple of other SNCC people are told that they can do a project in Louisiana, but I think by a vote of 19-18, they can't do it under the auspices of SNCC. And that's because of, again, there's definitely a sentiment of Black nationalism that's coming out, wondering, you know, how can an organization for Black liberation have white people in it? I mean, obviously, I think that's much more, people have come to terms with that in a different way now, 40 years later, but at the time, it's a much more complex question. But Carmichael himself is a singularly important figure, and the reason why I spend so much time on him is that we rarely think of Carmichael as a civil rights organizer turned Black Power militant. And that's exactly what happened. Carmichael is arrested for the first time when he's 19 years old in the South. He's a freedom rider. He's on the 17th Freedom Ride in between New Orleans and Mississippi. And he spends 49 days in jail. He spends his 20th birthday in jail in 1961. And that's the first of 27 arrests between 61 and 66. And so what's interesting is to understand Carmichael's Black Power rhetoric, you have to see him in a very holistic way and to say, you know, this is somebody who was organizing in Washington, D.C., organizing in Cambridge, Maryland, going to Mississippi as early as 1961, spending the summer of 63 there, spending the summer of 64 as a project director, including working very intimately and closely with whites, right? So the notion of Stokely Carmichael as some kind of wild-eyed maniac, some kind of emotionally disturbed, angry militant is about the furthest thing from the truth. That the historical record shows. And in fact, Carmichael is one of the earliest and most robust proponents of small-d democracy. And unlike a lot of people 40 years later, he actually put his life on the line for this, right? So what's interesting is Carmichael is in Mississippi Delta. He's in Lowndes County. He's sleeping on the floors of sharecroppers, things that most Americans would never even dream of doing, ever, now or then, right? So he's part of a small group of people who actually believe in the country. and the merits of the country and the sacred principles that the founding fathers put down, but then understands the dramatic gulf between rhetoric and reality. And for him, black power is the next step to really reduce that gulf between rhetoric and reality. Certainly later on, he's going to become a Pan-Africanist, and he has those Pan-African impulses, and a revolutionary Pan-Africanist going to leave the United States by 1969 permanently. But in the 60s, we have to look at him as this proponent of radical democracy, a black power activist who really feels, like he wrote in The New Republic in 1966, that democracy's best face is etched in the visages of black sharecroppers who are poor, who are semi-literate, illiterate, who don't have birth certificates, are never going to have certificates of death, who are living in a feudal system, under a system of white supremacy. And if their lives are like that, then there is no democracy in the country. You know, and to connect him to black power is very, very important. And one of the things I write in the book is, you know, President Obama, Barack Obama, writes in his memoir, Dreams from My Father, how he saw Stokely Carmichael in the early 1980s. And as Kwame Ture at Columbia, and he writes about him in a very dismissive way. He says that Stokely or Kwame Ture is asked a question by a young white student about, you know, how do you turn this revolutionary rhetoric into pragmatic reality, and he just dismisses her, supposedly, allegedly, and he says that Carmichael or Kwame Ture's eyes glowed, the eyes of a madman or a saint, right? And Obama claims, and again, he's 33, 34, writing this memoir, that the movement had died years ago, shattered into 1,000 pieces. And what's unfortunate about that assertion is, one, it's not true, but two, it's a very romantic and flattened and simplistic vision of what the civil rights movement was about and how it evolved. But it's one that's very emblematic of how the public conceives of civil rights, which is why Obama won the presidency. He is a reflection, and he could narrate a very simplistic good versus evil story, a very simplistic story where it's really very top-down. You know, Rosa sat, Martin Luther King comes in there, it's a top-down, King transforms America with the help of LBJ and John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, he's assassinated, and the movement fragments into thousands of pieces. Empirically, that's not what happened. The movement was always a movement that had fits and starts, that had really more failures than successes, and really was not supported by the majority of Americans at its high point, right? And we're still dealing with the reverberations of all these contradictions, because 40 years later, we can celebrate Dr. King's birthday, but we don't celebrate King as the critic of American democracy. We leave King frozen in time, August 28, 1963, at the March on Washington, beloved community, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, free at last. And Obama is a reflection of the difficulties of really trying to get a more complex narrative of the civil rights period, and hence of our contemporary race relations for the larger general public.
You mentioned Stokely's FBI file earlier, and I must ask, what does that file say about these limited interpretations or these limited views of pivotal black power figures, and also this notion of Carmichael, this false notion of Carmichael as madman?
Well, I think the file adds huge complexity to Carmichael. I think it shows, among other things, that this is somebody who was taken very serious by the federal government, very serious by the FBI, by the White House, by the State Department, by J. Edgar Hoover. It shows that this is somebody who is very pragmatic, even by the time he becomes an iconic national political mobilizer from local organizer. He's trying to put together all the disparate strands of black power. Carmichael's the one who organized the first iteration of the Black Panther Party in Lowndes County, Alabama, and it's from Lowndes County that you're going to get the Oakland version of the Panthers with Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale in October 66, and you're seeing him trying to put all these different groups together in the Bay Area, in Lowndes County, in Harlem. He's speaking in Canada. By 1967, he goes away from July 15th, 67 to around December 11th, and he's going to be in London for less than 2 weeks, but then in Cuba for a month. He's going to be in Vietnam with Ho Chi Minh. He's going to be in China. He's going to be in West Africa, in Guinea, where he meets Conakry, where he meets Kwame Nkrumah, the deposed leader of Ghana, Sékou Touré, the president of Guinea, And Amilcar Cabral, the leader of the PAIGC, the independence movements and the guerrillas who are struggling in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. And he's also going to be in Europe and in Oslo and Switzerland and Paris. Incredible journey. And what I think the FBI files show is that this is somebody who is really one of the most important figures of the post-war period, and show the way in which he's very strategic in terms of trying to craft political alliances, very strategic in terms of trying to build a movement that can transform contemporary race relations. And they also show that he's really one of the most important anti-war activists of the period. I mean, one of the things that Stokely Carmichael is not remembered for and should be is as one of the earliest proponents of resisting and refusing the Vietnam War draft. Carmichael comes out against the war in a much more robust way than Martin King. King comes out against the war in April 4th, 1967 in New York's Riverside Church. Carmichael is coming out against the war in the spring of 1966. SNCC comes out against the war in January of 1966. And Carmichael does a huge anti-war speech at Berkeley at the end of October of 1966 before 10,000 students, and he's the one who's innovating the chants of "Hell no, we won't go" at black colleges, historically black colleges and universities, and white schools too. And the FBI is intensely interested in that. The FBI is writing that, hey, this guy's spoken to over a quarter of a million people over the last few months, and this is working. And this is, they're very, very concerned with. So you're finding huge evidence that this is a very, very important figure, but also a complicated figure who, even as he has this critique against American democracy, is not this emotional prophet of rage, but just really a very nuanced, complicated political activist who still has a philosopher in him. He was a philosophy major at Howard University, could have gotten a PhD at Harvard, turned that down to continue his full-time organizing, and he's quoting Camus. He's quoting Frantz Fanon, he's quoting Malcolm X, he's a voracious reader. By 66, 67, he's writing the book Black Power with the political scientist Charles Hamilton, and really trying to figure things out, connecting the local, regional, national, and global politics all together.
So it would seem to me that looking at the FBI file or how a government tracks any particular figure is, in a strange irony, the best way to reassess or reinvigorate or have a less predictable view of someone like Stokely Carmichael.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that combined with other sources, because there's great papers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Carmichael has his own papers as well, some of which are available. There's oral histories with the people who were there. But no, the FBI files, the thousands of pages really give you a great example of the itinerary, where he traveled, who he met. These are things you cross-reference and check with other sources, because at times the FBI is wrong. They're going to say, hey, we have a source who told us he was at a CP meeting, Communist Party United States of America meeting, and then later on you'll see the source says, well, it wasn't him. But it does give you a great reference and research tool in terms of trying to collectively reinterpret his life.
But if the FBI is drawing false conclusions based off of a narrative that has pockmarks like this, then I'm curious if you determined any FBI conclusions in this that didn't line up, that were not confirmed by these other sources, and that actually caused them to have a false view of Carmichael or even another figure.
Well, yeah, no, I think so. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of misinformation, in the sense the FBI is relying on sources. So at times, for instance, they're going to be concluding that he's coming back from Cuba with guerrilla training to foment waves of urban insurrection. Because that was one of the FBI's major fears, was that black power leaders were going to be able to orchestrate, really single-handedly, violent insurrections in the United States, whether it's Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panthers. And at times you get memos to the effect that this is what's going on, and you really know that these sources are wrong, because the people they're claiming are in one place, you know, empirically, verifiably, are somewhere else. So a lot of the conclusions of the FBI that these black powerites were going to foment this kind of wave of self-destruction, a wave of destruction in our urban cities, was off.
One last question. Tavis Smiley was taken to task when he was criticizing Obama. Is there any prospect for the militant messages or the radicalism of the 1960s, could you look to any figure today and say, oh, that person may actually get through? Or have we whittled or winnowed down the connections to the point where that is no longer possible for the very media reasons we were citing earlier? But also, is there any way to get through, or is it really possibly going to be just online or something like that?
Yeah, no, I think radicalism still exists, and I think that Black Power radicalism still exists. I think the what we're seeing, and I think we saw this during the Obama campaign, one of the things I alluded to earlier is that radicals and pragmatists were behind this Obama campaign. And I think generally that's true, but I still know that there were left critics, Black leftists, Black powerite on the left, critics of Obama, who stood on the sidelines and basically were criticizing, saying he was the new face of imperialism, all these different things, right? The problem there, though, is that what Obama showed and the social movement that carries him into office showed was that much of that left did not have an institutional or mass base, right? They might have a local face. They might have bookstores, cultural centers, be able to even get 1,000 people out to a protest, but they didn't have the concrete base or appeal to really blunt Obama's appeal to masses of people, including African-American progressives and some radicals and leftists. So one of the things that we're seeing, and an interesting anecdote that I write about in the book, is on August 1st, 2008, Obama is heckled by Black powerites in St. Petersburg, Florida, part of the Uhuru movement, connected to Omali Yeshitela, formerly Joe Waller, who was a contemporary of Stokely Carmichael and SNCC, and had a Black power organization in Florida called the Junta of Militant Organizations, or JOMO, in the late 60s, early 70s. And that got traction for a few days, and they were criticizing him as this sellout. But what I found really interesting is that with Uhuru and Obama, you saw two visions of Black power. And I don't think either of them were acknowledging the other. Obama was a pragmatic version and moderate version. They were the continuation of an anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, very serious critique that continues from the 1960s onward. And it predates the 60s. But what's interesting is that even as they're in St. Petersburg, they didn't have enough traction to be able to meet with candidate Obama behind the scenes to press him. Right. So part of what I think the Obama phenomenon has shown is that the Black left, including those who are online, who are bloggers and different stuff, are really in a position where the mass appeal that was there in the 1960s and 70s and that had institutional base in the Gary Convention, had organizations like SNCC, the Panthers, right? It certainly, there's still disparate local forces, but we're not seeing the ability to congeal and have a mass appeal. Because one of the things the Black left has to ask itself, including critics of Obama, is that why the mass appeal? I think they've answered that in a too simplistic, flattened way in saying that Obama just fooled the masses of people. So the problem there becomes you're saying, well, Black people and white progressives, everybody got fooled, but why can't you make your own case? Because remember, the Panthers made a case, Stokely Carmichael made a case, they made community organizing, and they got grassroots support. So Stokely couldn't have brought 900 people to the polls in Lowndes County in May of 1966 by himself. So he made a case, and there was support, right? The problem in our contemporary period in 2010 is, why is there an inability of a Black left or leftist side of the Black power movement that, let's say, for instance, is not supportive of Obama, to make that case and to have that mass appeal? And I think that's the real question. And certainly the media is a part of this. Certainly you're not going to get the New York Times as a platform anymore. You're not going to get the New York Review of Books. But there still has to be, if you're organizing, and I think Obama proved that, and the social movement around Obama proved. So when I say Obama proved that, I mean the phenomena of Obama. I don't mean, I dispute the notion that this is just the speechwriter, John Favreau, or it's any of the geniuses, in quotes, David Axelrod, or even the candidate himself. I actually think that it's a social movement that they didn't start and that they really can't stop in its own way. That catapulted him into office.
Well, on that interesting note about what the future may bring, thank you so much, Padil, for taking the time. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you, Pat. All right.
mamas with Alzheimer's, line up, please. All mommies with mind freeze, please line up, please. All bloggers with comments, please. I come in peace to see if we can cure your amnesia by the time I leave. All mommies I heard before vouch for me. Tell them about the time on your mama's couch, mommy. All hustlers who ever bought an eight from me. Take this time out and set the record straight for me. Remember me, silver bullet.